The master bathroom vanity littered with men's deodorant, shaving cream, and my razor. Eden turns on me and says, "Oh, hell no. Just no." "It's my room," I advise her, wondering what is running through that beautiful head of hers. "This room used to be her parents', then it was her grandmother's, and now it's mine. Been in it almost 6 months now, and not moving out for you." Her gaze cuts over to the spiral staircase, and she gives a heavy sigh of longing. I don't blame her. That room up there is fabulous, filled with all kinds of books, chaise lounges, and plush oriental carpets you can sink your feet into. It's the best place to hang out in the house. Without looking at me, Eden picks up her suitcases and walks out of my bedroom. I again follow silently, and she goes where I expect her to. Her old bedroom. It hadn't changed since she left for college, except for new bedding that Valeria must have bought for it. But it's still the same bed that took our virginity, and I can remember that night as clear as if it happened yesterday. I've fucked a lot of women since Eden, can't remember a lot of those, but I can remember that night we both gave it up to each other. Eden walks over to the large closet and drops her suitcases again, this time without much care, and they thud, the smaller case tipping over. By the hunch of her shoulders, I can tell she's exhausted and confused, and I wish I felt more empathy for her, but I don't. She left me and Newbury far behind. Even more, that was so long ago, I just can't be upset about how things have changed. I took care of her near the end, I say quietly, and Eden's body jerks slightly before she turns to face me. I continue. She was really unstable, not able to get around without a wheelchair, couldn't drive. I mean, she had hired help that would come in and bathe her and stuff, but I took her to her doctor's appointments and came most days to keep her company. She had no friends, no one that cared to come visit. I did that for a very long time because I liked her and I felt sorry for her, but I didn't expect anything in return. Providing me the life estate was as much a shock to me as it was to you.
Why? She asks in a muted voice. Why would you ever do those things for her?
Because Valeria ended up not being the grandmother you remembered, I say with a shrug. She mellowed with age, was kinder. I think she was lonely and she didn't have anyone.
She never said anything to me,
she says defensively. You never asked, I retort.
She wasn't a grandmother to me, and you of all people know that, Coop. The day my parents died was the day I lost any type of familial love or support.
Eden snaps at me.
You have no right to judge my relationship or lack thereof with her.
I narrow my eyes at her and do something I promised I'd never do if I ever saw Eden again. Do I have the right to judge the lack of relationship you had with me? For a moment, Eden's face softens and her eyes glisten, but then she blinks those eyes framed with thick, dark lashes, causing the green in her eyes to radiate brightly, and her features harden.
I think the only thing you're capable of doing is judging, Coop. At least that's the way I remember it. So by all means, let's hear what you have to say about our lack of a relationship.
And yeah, she uses air quotes around those last words. Taking a deep breath, I try to seek some perspective here. I don't know why she's got me riled up so quickly, or how she's even got me riled up at all. Over the years, I've turned into a man who's bothered by little. So I need to show her that this is who she's dealing with. With a nonchalant shrug, I tell her, nah, it's really not worth the time. It was so long ago, and in the grand scheme of things, we didn't really have anything special going on. Eden gasps, and I get a sense of validation for just the briefest of moments. Then I take in the disappointed look on her face, and I feel like shit. Brushing it off, because who wants to dwell on crappy feelings, I turn toward the door and mutter, well, hope he gets settled in all right. I walk over the threshold, grab the knob, and start to pull the door closed behind me, but her soft voice halts me in my tracks.
Do you think we'd still be together today if Carlos hadn't approached me in that mall 14 years ago?
My head spins, because that is some question indeed. Carlos Sanchez was a modeling scout and agent, and had a talent for picking superstars. He spotted Eden in a local mall as we were walking along and doing some window shopping one weekend in Atlanta. And he started her down a path that led her away from me for good. Since then, I've changed a fuck of a lot, and I don't know that I can credit all of it to Eden leaving, but I can sure pinpoint my lack of interest in relationships being due to that. Not really knowing for sure, and figuring lying to her would be pointless, I tell her the only thing I know. I have no clue, Eden. None at all. I shut the door and leave her behind. As I trot down the staircase to the first floor, I pull my phone out of my pocket. When I reach the foyer, I pull up Ashley's number, intent on seeing if she's busy tonight. We've got our date Saturday night, but damn Eden and her riling ways, I need to work off some frustration. I stare at it a long, hard moment, and although the word Ashley is prominent on my screen, all I can see is Eden's face staring back at me. It's a face I would have been happy to stare at for the rest of my life once upon a time. Fuck, I mutter, and then exit Ashley's contact. I pull up Clay's number instead. He answers on the second ring. What's up, dude? I'll be at Tilly's in about 15 minutes, I tell him as I turn to the foyer table and nab my keys. Drinks are on me. No can do, muchacho, Clay says. Janine's pissed at me because I forgot to put the garbage out by the curb this morning. Don't be a pussy, I taunt him as I walk out the door and pull it shut behind me. I automatically lock it, not only to keep people from stealing, but because Eden's in there now. 15 minutes. But I disconnect the call and hop into my truck to head to Tilly's. It's one of three local bars in Newbury, but it's my favorite by far. It's where most of my friends hang out, the food is excellent, and they have pretty good bands. Add that they have the best drink specials in town, and, well, it's why I go there. And after that exchange with Eden, I really need to get drunk. I'm still completely off balance having seen her. She's not the same woman I knew all those years ago, but there's still a lot of her that's familiar. Just hearing her voice, or looking into her expressive eyes, makes me remember back when we were young and in love, believing nothing would ever get in our way. It was one of the happiest times of my life, especially when we went off to college together. Clay actually beats me there, but then again he lives in the town limits and could have walked there in 5 minutes. I take a seat at the bar next to him and he turns on his stool. When the judge asks me why Janine's divorcing me, I'm going to have to list you as our irreconcilable difference. Janine forgives you for everything, I point out to him after a massive eye roll. They've been together since high school. Clay graduated with Eden and me, but Janine was 2 years younger than us. They've survived some major ups and downs, but 12 years of marriage and 2 kids later, they're still going strong, no matter how much Clay bitches otherwise. So why they need to drink on a Thursday night? Clay asks as he holds up 2 fingers to the bartender and calls out, Jack! The bartender nods, and within moments we have shots of whiskey in front of us. Eden's in town, I mutter as I pick up the shot glass and down it. Staying at Goodnight House. Christ, Clay mutters and drinks his shot too. I'm going to have to be DD tonight, ain't I? I push my glass toward the edge of the bar and it's quickly filled again. Clay asks for a Pepsi. Is it weird staying in the same house with her? He asks. Yup, I answer, and then grin wickedly at myself in the mirror behind the bar. I down the second shot and chuckle as I slide it back to the edge of the bar. Let's just say she was not happy I'm living in the master bedroom, and she had no clue about the life estate Valeria left me, so she was shocked as shit to find me there. How could she not know? Clay asked in disbelief. I shrug. I'm guessing she didn't even bother to look at the estate documents. Guess not, Clay mutters. But otherwise, how is she doing? No clue, I tell him. Didn't stick around to talk to her. Clay's silent for a moment, but I know he's thinking about what to say to me. He's been my best friend since middle school and watched my love affair with Eden develop, then fail. While I wasn't overly sharing with him about what it did to me all those years ago, he knows enough to know it's complicated with her. but I asked him out for drinks tonight because I also know he'll give me perspective on how to handle her. I have no clue if she'll be here 2 days or 2 weeks. Hopefully the former. But I know Clay will have good advice on how to handle it. He's always had my back like that.
You need to fuck her, he finally says.
What?
I bark out as I snap my head toward him in astonishment.
Okay, he says calmly, but his eyes hold all kinds of mischief. I can tell by your reaction that is not an option at all, so I'm going to point out that since it seems you've moved on, she's moved on, you have no interest in her, and she probably has no interest in you, plus you're currently in a relationship with Ashley. You need to be polite with Eden, but just go about your life as if she's not here.
I'm not in a relationship with Ashley, I grumble.
You fucking her exclusively?
I am right now only because she's been great in the sack and hasn't pushed me for much, and he knows that, so I don't bother confirming. I turn the conversation back to where it needs to go. So I do my best to ignore her while we live under the same roof and just go about my life as if she's not here.
Exactly.
It's a good plan. It's the right plan. The bartender raises the bottle to pour me another shot, but I shake my head at him. I don't feel like getting blitzed.
You still pissed at her, dude?
Clay asks, suspiciously. Because if so, then I'll amend my advice to suggesting maybe you come stay with me and Janine while she's in town.
Nah, I'm good with it, I tell him quickly.
Although that's not the full truth. I am angry at circumstances that drove us apart. There's a knock on my dorm room door and I glance at my clock. It's late, almost midnight. My roommate is out with his girlfriend and I've been cramming for a test tomorrow. I get up and pad to the door wearing nothing but a pair of gym shorts, surprised to see Eden on the other side when I open it.
Hey, baby, I say as I take her face in my hands to give her a quick kiss before pulling her into my room. She's got on a pair of pink pajama pants and a baggy sweatshirt. Her hair is braided into two ponytails that hang over her shoulders. Her room is just one floor above mine, and I hate it. It's not close enough, but as close as I can get with co-ed dorms.
What are you doing here? Figured you'd be in bed.
You're never going to guess what just happened? She says as she walks past me and then turns around. Her cheeks are flushed, her eyes are sparkling, and I know it's not from the kiss I just gave her.
What? I ask with a smile.
Mr. Sanchez just called me. And a really big fashion magazine wants to hire me for a modeling project?
She practically squeals as she jumps up and down.
He said they loved my test shots he sent them, and also he's got some other people interested in me too.
I can't help it. Her enthusiasm is contagious, and I pull her in for a hard hug.
That's awesome, Eden. But how could they not love you? You're the most beautiful woman in the world.
Eden gives an embarrassed laugh and pushes me away from her. She's always been shy like that when I compliment her.
But that's not the most amazing part,
she says in a rush and then gushes so fast I almost can't understand her.
They're going to pay me $25,000 for the photo shoot.
Holy shit, I say on an exhale. That's a lot of damn money.
She nods her head. The shoot can be done on a weekend. They'll fly me to New York and back, and I will have tuition and expenses covered for this year and most of next.
This was huge, because Valeria Goodnight refused to pay for Eden's education when she chose to come to University of Georgia with me. Valeria wanted her to go to Vanderbilt, which was her alma mater, and she thought withholding money would deter Eden. It only made her more determined, and she's been working her ass off at an extra job and doing some tutoring to supplement what she didn't get in grants and scholarships.
Mr. Sanchez says that I could easily make up to $100,000 a year doing just modeling shoots like this.
She continues to gush.
And he said that would probably lead to some offers to walk runways and fashion shows, but I told him I could only do that in the summer when I wasn't in classes.
Eden continues on and on about all the things her agent is promising her. But the moment she mentioned the insane amount of money she could make, my heart had plummeted to the bottom of my stomach. This was no joke. It was some serious shit. Eden could have a big-time career modeling and making lots of money. And while that was never something she had ever dreamed about doing as a career, I can see how excited she is right now. This is what people call a life-changing event. It was the beginning of the end for us. Looking back, I realize it was the very first offer that did it. Eden downplayed it later after she returned from the shoot, but soon Carlos was calling her with offer after offer. Eden just couldn't refuse, as the potential for huge success was within her grasp. And so she left, because you couldn't be a full-time student and jet all over the world to walk runways. Of course, I stayed behind.
Chapter 5. She was never there for me. Eden. I placed my shampoo and hair conditioner in the newly cleaned-out master shower and shut the glass door. I look around the bathroom with satisfaction. My makeup and face creams are laid out and fresh towels are hanging on the racks. I smile as I walk into the master bedroom and survey the changes I'd made over the last few hours. My mission started the minute I heard Coop leaving for work early this morning. I was awake most of the night stewing about this man living in my home, and I was not getting the peace and solitude that I was craving. I leapt out of bed as soon as his truck cleared the driveway. After a rushed cup of coffee and a quick shower, I donned a pair of workout capris and a stretch tank and wrapped my wet hair on top of my head. After putting on my best running shoes, I was ready to go. The first thing I did was get a large green garbage bag from under the kitchen sink and put every single item of Coop's from the bathroom in it. I then dragged it out and left it in the hall. Next, I carried out all of his clothes by the armload, emptied drawers, pulled stuff off hangers, and I threw it all out into the hallway. As I did so, I tried to envision this room the way I remember it, when my parents were alive. Even though it was their room, I spent a lot of time in here. As a child, if I was afraid of something at night, my parents would let me crawl into their big bed and sleep between them. Or I'd play chess with my dad in the upstairs library, or just veg out up there with my mom while we read books on a lazy weekend. I was a little more careful with his personal possessions, like the picture of him and his dad together that actually made me smile. I was hoping I'd run into Coop's dad soon so I could say hello to him. He was a sweet bear of a man, and I miss him. Pictures, books, and a pair of handcuffs I found in the nightstand drawer all went into the box. Admittedly, I couldn't stop thinking about why he'd have those there, although really, I knew why. I wasn't stupid. I also flushed warm thinking about Coop and cuffs, but I eventually drove those thoughts out of my head and focused on my annoyance over the situation. When the room was cleared, I quickly moved my stuff in, making sure to unpack and hang all my clothes, put my panties and bras in the drawers, and fill the bathroom with my girly stuff. I even sprayed one of my favorite body mists around the bathroom and onto the bedding, which I'd also brought over from my room, as it was more feminine than the dark green bedding Coop had. That was also lying in a pile in the hallway. The attorney explained to me clearly yesterday that Coop did inherit a life estate of Goodnight House. That meant that this was his house as much as mine, and he was entitled to live in it if he chose for the remainder of his life. It took me a few moments, but I accepted it. It was Valeria's choice, what she did with the house, and if Coop truly took care of her the last few years, I wasn't going to begrudge her decision. But I'll be damned if he was going to get the master suite with the fabulous third-floor library and sitting room. It was one of the things that made Goodnight House magical, with its stained glass windows, tall shelves crammed with books that required a rolling ladder to reach, and plush seating in which you could either read or take a long nap, all of which I wanted to take advantage of while I was here. Coop said he wasn't moving out of the room, so I went ahead and helped him along with that. My smile grew bigger as I imagined the look on his face when he came home tonight. Satisfied with my work, I decided to enjoy my new space. I turned to the wrought iron spiral staircase and walked slowly up to the sanctuary beckoning me. I spent a moment when I reached the third floor just looking around at things. The furniture was fairly new. I'm guessing added by Valeria sometime since I'd left home to go to college. I seriously doubt Coop would have chosen the cream leather chaise with lacy pillows and pale lavender, or the sumptuous rug of cream flowers on a gray background. I walk to the first bookcase, which runs contiguously around the large, circular room that boasts 12-foot ceilings. I place my hand on the rich mahogany wood and drag my fingers along the edge as I peruse the titles while walking the perimeter. I see the classics, like F. Scott Fitzgerald, Jane Austen, and Tolstoy. A few cases down are my mom's favorites. She was into romance and a huge Nora Roberts fan. Beside those are my dad's books, almost all nonfiction. There are even two shelves with my favorites, which include a complete set of every one of Dean Koontz's books.
"What the holy fuck did you do?"
I hear Coop bellow from below. My entire body tenses, and a jolt of adrenaline spikes through me. I knew he'd be pissed, and I'd have to deal with him, but I wasn't ready for it to happen this soon. I have no clue what he's doing here in the middle of the day. I hear him stomping through the bedroom as I rush over to the spiral staircase. I look down just as his foot is on the bottom step. His hands on the railing, he looks up at me with ferocity and demands,
"Are you fucking insane?"
"Not that I know of," I answer pertly as I start to descend the staircase. "I merely took what was mine by right." Coop doesn't move out of my way when I near the bottom. His jaw is clenched so tight, he has a muscle jumping at the corner.
"It is not yours by right. It was mine. I was settled in here,"
he says, in a low, guttural voice that makes the hair on the back of my neck stand up. I'm not sure if it's because his voice is sexy or frightening with the underlying menace in it. "This has been my house far longer than it has been yours," I point out calmly, even though my racing pulse says otherwise. Still, I stiffen my spine and stand my ground. "I'm keeping this room."
"You are such a spoiled, princess-like brat,"
he snarls at me as he comes up full on the bottom step, which puts him face to face with me.
"Nothing but a diva, although frankly I didn't expect any different."
I suck in a harsh breath, his words slicing deep. When I force the air back out, I snap back at him. "You know nothing about me."
"I know plenty,"
he says with a grimace, clearly showing his dislike.
"I know you never bothered to come back here to see Valeria except for her funeral, that she died a lonely old woman. You turned your back on your heritage and your family business and your hometown because you were too good for all of this."
His words almost cause my knees to buckle as I'm weighted down with guilt and regret and my nose starts to sting. But there is no way in hell I'm going to let him see me cry, and the only way I know how to stave off the tears is to defend myself. "You know nothing of Valeria or what we were to each other. You may have seen a lonely old woman, but I was her granddaughter, and I was nothing to her. She was emotionally closed off and distant. She was controlling, and when she didn't get her way, she cut me out without a backward glance. She never called me. It was always me calling her to check in. But fuck, Coop. You can only reach out so many times and get the door shut in your face before you eventually give up. She never once said she was proud of me, never acknowledged my accomplishments, never offered support when I was down. So don't give me this shit about her dying a lonely old woman. She apparently had you, but I've had no one." During my rant, I saw the heat start to cool in Coop's eyes as he considered my words. I'm not sure of the depth of talks that he had with Valeria as they got closer, but I can tell he really doesn't know anything about me as a person. I barrel down the next two steps and push my way past him. He moves easily to the side, and I cling to the railing so we don't touch. Marching to the bathroom, I almost stop when he says,
"I just stopped by to grab a quick sandwich for lunch, but I want this shit cleaned up and my room put to rights by the time I get home tonight."
He gets nothing but my back and my silence as I stomp into the master bath and slam the door shut. I'm going to take a nice, long bath. And then perhaps I'll go into town for lunch myself. I'm on vacation. I have no agenda. I can do what I want. And I absolutely do not want to put Coop's room to rights. Too bad for him. I'm staying right here. I pass by Goodnight Textiles as I head into Newberry. It's the largest textile plant in the South and third largest in the United States. A certain fondness for it warms me because my dad put his blood, sweat, and tears into the family business he inherited. It's now being run by his brother, who moved from CFO to CEO after my parents died. However, he runs the company from his home base of Chicago, and he's a city slicker to the core. Of course, grandmother sat on the board of directors and had a lot of input about how to run the empire she'd also helped to create. I'd heard through the cousin grapevine that she actually became more involved after her fourth husband died and she gave up on remarrying. I suppose it was a way to occupy her time when she wasn't traveling. Regardless, the family business was never for me. Even before I fell into modeling, I was considering a career in law. I wasn't sure why or if that was what I really wanted, but it's one of the things I was greatly interested in. I figured I'd be exposed to a lot of things in college that could lead me in a different direction, and ironically, that's exactly what happened to me. Things changed radically when Carlos Sanchez walked into my life, and my education sort of became moot. Newberry hasn't changed much that I can see. It would be considered a small town with a population of close to 5,000, even less when I lived here. Most of the businesses are independently owned, and everyone knows everyone. It's been 14 years since I've surveyed the town's streets, and I feel like a stranger now. Even though I see the same old storefront signs on the businesses bordering the main square, for a moment I feel discombobulated as I drive into town, like I'm seeing it for the first time. I find a parallel parking spot in front of my first destination, which is the local diner called the Pit Stop. I'm starved, and I didn't even bother to see what type of food Coop had in the house. He could have had a fully stocked pantry and fridge, but I wasn't touching any of it. So I'm going to eat lunch and run to the grocery store so I have my own food. Almost everyone turns in their seats when I walk in. The large window bordering the sidewalk made my entrance public, and while I'm used to people staring at me because of my fame, this is different, and weirdly disconcerting. These are my hometown folks, and I don't want them looking at me as if they don't know me. There are several people I don't recognize, but who clearly know who I am. Some of them look awestruck, and I hope that doesn't lead to someone tipping off the paparazzi that I'm here. One woman gives me a hesitant smile, but the others look at me like I'm a stranger. And really, I am. I see Mason Woodward, who graduated a year behind me, sitting with Debbie Hemp. I smile at them, but they just look at me with blank stares. As I make my way to an empty booth, because at the Pit Stop, you seat yourself, I smile and nod at others I know. George Moulton, who runs the local garage, and Suzanne Daly, who owns the hair salon I used to go to. They're older by 14 years, but they're still the same people. I smile at them, and they don't smile back. This is disconcerting, but I figure perhaps they are nervous or shy around me since I've become a celebrity. I hope they get over that fast, because I have never wanted to be treated that way. As I slide into the red vinyl booth and grab one of the menus, I catch the eye of Bonnie Ventura, who I'm surprised to see is still a waitress here. She was old when I'd left town, but she hasn't changed that much. Her iron gray hair is still short and permed, and her face is overly powdered. She stares at me a moment before she goes back to filling coffee cups at a table, and I assume she'll be over soon to take my order, so I give a quick perusal of the menu. 15 minutes later, I'm still waiting on Bonnie to come to my table. I've tried to catch the other waitress's attention, but she won't even make eye contact with me. It's only when Bonnie has to pass me to bring food to the table beside me that I finally get her to stop. "Bonnie, I'm ready to give my order," I call out, and she ignores me. She doles out plates of food, sweet-talking up the group of guys in for lunch. She calls them sweetie and honey pie. Finally, she straightens, pulls her order pad from the pocket of her apron and her pencil from behind her ear, and turns to me with a huff. "What do you want?" Her voice is cold and unwelcoming, and I am completely flummoxed. "Well, hello to you too, Bonnie. It's good to see you after so long." She just stares at me, tapping the end of her pencil against the pad. "Okay," I say as I look down to the menu. "I'll take a burger and fries, and some ice water." Bonnie jots a few notes and doesn't say a word as she turns her back on me. I watch her, with my mouth hanging wide open, completely stunned by her rudeness. I look around the diner, and no one is looking at me anymore. In fact, I'd say I'm being patently ignored. This is just weird. And I know there's clearly something wrong when it takes almost half an hour for Bonnie to serve me my burger, which is cold, and my fries, which are over-salted. I never did get my glass of ice water. I eat a few bites, but the food and the reception are unpalatable. I throw a 20 down on the table and walk out, my head spinning over the way Bonnie treated me. Still starved as I walk back to my car, and a little depressed over my homecoming so far, I spy a new business that wasn't here the last time I'd been in town. It's called Missy's Cupcake Gallery. And, well, the word cupcake garnered all my attention. I walk down to it and open the glass door, immediately assaulted by the wonderful smells of chocolate and cream and strawberries and cinnamon. I inhale deeply as my eyes immediately start roaming over a huge glass case of cupcakes on display. "Well, if it isn't Eden Goodnight, return to town," I hear a soft, feminine voice say from behind the counter. My head pops up, and I look at a petite, slender woman of about my age. She has strawberry blonde hair, worn in a chin-length bob, and beautiful porcelain skin made more beautiful by freckles. She's giving me a genuine smile, and I absorb it deeply. So bad had been my experience at the pit stop. I assume the woman recognizes me from the movies I've done, so I put on my most gracious smile. "Those cupcakes are calling out to me." She nods knowingly, her eyes sparkling. "What's your poison?" "Chocolate, first and foremost," I tell her as my eyes go back to the case. Rows upon rows of cupcakes with different colored icing and sprinkles. "But honestly, anything sweet is good by me. My sweet tooth has always been a problem." "I remember," the woman laughs, and my head snaps back up to look at her again. "Our National Honor Society bake sales were never that successful, because you tended to eat half the product." I can't help the subtle narrowing of my eyes and the tilt of my head as I try to place this woman. But nothing's coming to me, and I have to concede defeat. "I'm really sorry, but do we know each other?" The woman grins big. "I'd hope so. We graduated high school together." My brow furrows deeper, and it's clear I'm blanking. I feel horrible that I'm blanking because it seems rude, and I am not a rude person. With a tinkling laugh, she says, "Time to let you off the hook. I'm about 150 pounds lighter than when you last saw me." And then it hits me, all at once. "Missy Chambers!" I exclaim. "Oh my God, look at you. You look amazing." "Yeah, the double chin didn't earn me any favors in high school," she says amicably. Immediately, a wave of guilt slams into me as I realize I wasn't friends with Missy. Sure, we'd say hello if we passed each other in the hallway, but we didn't hang. She was never invited to the parties I went to. She wasn't in our social circle. With a gut-churning feeling of dismay, I realize she ate lunch by herself an awful lot. "It's okay," she says immediately, and I'm embarrassed she was actually reading my mind. I wasn't the most socially outgoing person back then, and I know it's wholly ironic that I own a cupcake shop after losing all that weight, but still, it's good to see you again. My cheeks turn red. You're kinder than I probably deserve. Missy gives an impatient wave of her hand at me, then points back at the case. So go on, pick one. It's on the house. And with a grateful smile that there is at least one person in this town who isn't displeased to see me, I choose a chocolate cupcake with white icing. I latch onto that cupcake and the kindness that Missy's showing me. It's the first really nice thing that's happened to me in a few days, and I might be glorifying her and the cupcake just a little. I eat my treat right there as Missy fills me in on everything she's been doing the last 14 years, which includes a bad marriage that led to a hardcore devotion to healthy eating and exercise. And some things are coming back to me. Didn't you go to school up north? She nods. Yep. And let me just say, winter in the north sucks. But I met my husband there, and despite the fact he's an asshole, he did give me two great kids. My smile is big and genuine with interest. I've always wanted kids, but maybe that's not in the cards for me. What are their names? Lena is 7, and feisty as the day is long, Missy says with a proud expression on her face. And Thomas is 5, and he's sweet and loving. A total mama's boy. They sound wonderful. A twinge in my chest tells me that my prospects for having kids must not be very good since I can't even get love right. So, are you staying at Goodnight House? Missy asks, with mischief brewing in her eyes. And if so, I'll be nosy and ask, how awkward is it? Pretty awkward, I admit, but don't elaborate. I'm not surprised by the question. This is a small town, and it would be widely known that Coop was living in my house before I came back. Our history is well known, too. But I think we'll be just fine if we stay away from each other. Your house is certainly big enough, she quips, and I can't help but laugh. Speaking of which, with Coop at Goodnight House, at least I wouldn't run into him if I drop by his family home to say hello to his dad. I'll try to do that this weekend. Missy's eyes go round and then soften. You don't know, do you? Know what? I ask, but based on the empathy in her voice, dread fills me. His father died a few years ago, she says quietly. The middle school caught fire, and he was there with his ground crew, mowing. He went in to help get the kids out and saved several before he died. Big news around here. And yet it didn't reach all the way out to L.A., I think, bitterly. Grandmother didn't let me know, and I didn't have one single friend I'd left behind that I kept in touch with. I think it was easy to cut Newberry out of my life because my grandmother gave me no incentive to keep it. I know, at this moment, given the treatment by the folks at the pit stop and the fact I didn't know Coop's dad died, I should be feeling like a stranger in a foreign town. Oddly, though, I actually feel just plain old homesick. And I have no idea why.
Chapter 6. If it's war you want, Coop. I finish reading the article about Eden before sitting back in the kitchen chair. I'm the first to admit, in addition to riling me up, she's got me curious. She said things to me today at lunch that made me take stock of all the things I'd believed about her, particularly about how she ignored Valeria throughout the years. There are things about Eden that I thought were a sure bet, and that's based on local gossip, her actions, and her inactions. But I never did stop to think about it from her side. After I'd stormed out of the house at lunch, I went back to the office to finish the 3D renderings, but I couldn't concentrate. So I packed up my laptop, brought it back to the house, and set it on the kitchen table, intent on working from this new location. I sometimes work from home, as doing the landscape design is the one part of my job that can be done on a laptop from anywhere. But working on the 3D design was not the first thing that I did when I got back to the house. The minute I realized Eden's car was gone, and the house was empty, I decided to rectify some things. Namely, I dragged every bit of clothing, makeup, shoes, and hair care products out of the master suite and dumped them in the hall. I have no shame in admitting I admired her lingerie, which was sinful in an unexpected way. Eden's body has graced Sports Illustrated in a string bikini, and I've seen her completely naked, so I know how sexy and erotic she can be. But her panties and bras were all in soft pinks, blues, and sea greens, made of lace and sheer silk. I think most would assume Eden would be a black bustier with red satin trim type of woman, but the pastel colors are far sexier to me for some reason. I guess that softer side to a woman is what gets me, especially since I tend to be a little rough and controlling in bed. After ogling her panties, I dragged all the stuff back in, but I didn't have it in me to refold and hang all my clothes, so I stuffed them in the closet. The last thing I did was rip her rose-colored bedding off the mattress, also dumping it in the hallway, and put my manly green comforter back where it belonged. I trotted back down the stairs with every intention of getting to work, but somehow I found myself surfing the internet to learn more about the woman I've tried to forget for 14 years. I knew the basics. She went from an elite modeling career where most of it was spent in the major fashion houses in Paris, Milan, and New York to a breakout acting role 8 years ago that earned her an Oscar. Eden was a fucking incomparable beauty, which earned her lots of money with that gorgeous face and body. But if anyone doubted she could make the jump to serious acting, they were wrong. I happened to know how savvy Eden is, and she put her smarts to work to build an incredible career that's left her famous as well as mega rich, independent of her family's wealth. I do wonder, though, if her career is fulfilling to her. I get why she went for it. At 18, why wouldn't she try? Why would she let a silly thing like a boyfriend hold her back? Or perhaps I didn't try hard enough. Maybe I shouldn't have let her go. I wonder how things would have turned out had I done that. It did no good to speculate, so I focused on the recent news about Eden, and there was a ton of it. I popped her name in Google and got a slew of articles and social media posts about what happened earlier this week with her fiancé. I had not known she was engaged, and it was a bit of a punch when I found out from Ashley. But after watching the video of what went down outside that movie theater, there's no doubt that Brad Wright is a complete and utter douche. Not only did he fuck around on Eden, but he's since been spreading nasty lies about her, and because he's one of the world's biggest action stars, he's got a legion of female fans posting brutal and vicious things about Eden. Granted, she's got a big fan base too, but Eden's movies tend to attract tamer fans, and they're not as riled up as Brad's are. I saw tweets and Facebook posts about Eden, and I was stunned to see how hateful they were. Eden Goodnight's a cunt. Brad deserves better. Someone should stomp her ass into the ground. Wish it was me. Just a 2-bit, no-talent actress who tried to ride coattails. Go to hell, bitch. Jesus, these people were brutal. All women who apparently feel they have some masterful connection to the prick, but whatever. If Eden was reading this stuff, no wonder she's here in Newbury hiding. The thing that disturbed me the most was speculation by the press as to where Eden was hiding. They're focusing on the fact that Eden is supposed to be filming a new movie with Brad in a little over 4 weeks from now, and people are going crazy wondering how that's going to play out. Running my hand through my hair, I stare at the computer screen and thank God above that I'm just a simple man in a small town living a quiet life. I don't know how she puts up with that stuff. The sound of a car pulling up to the front of my house catches my attention. I exit out of my browser and pull up my project specs just as I hear the front door open. The kitchen sits at the back of the house, so unless Eden walks back here, she won't see me. She'll know I'm here because my truck is out front, but I wait to see where she goes. The clack of her shoes on the wood floors tells me she's wearing hard-soled heels, and the sound gets closer, so I brace for her to come into the kitchen. I turn my head just as she steps through the doorway.
What are you doing here?
She asks softly as she folds her arms over her chest and leans against the door jamb. I'm not about to tell her I came back to steal my room, so I just shrug. It's a Friday and not much going on. Just doing some computer work, and I can do it just as easy here as I can at the office. Eden nods and then stares at me pointedly. Finally, she says, I'm sorry about your father. I just heard today that he died. It doesn't happen every time I think of my dad, but it happens often enough. The soft sympathy and concern in Eden's voice causes it to happen now. A vicious twisting of my heart and a yearning for my father. We were as close as a parent and child could be, as he raised me on his own after my mother died in childbirth. Outside of the 4 years I'd gone to college, we worked together in the family business. Not a day went by that I didn't at least talk to him on the phone if I didn't see him. His death and the heroics that caused it are a pain that slices deep into me. I'm proud of him, yet angry at the same time. I'm also angry at Eden for acting like this is news to her when I know it's not. I know for a fact that she'd heard about my father's death. I hadn't really expected her to come to the funeral, but I expected at least an acknowledgement. Instead, there was nothing but silence. But that's old news, and it shed light on the type of person Eden had become after finding fame and fortune. Nothing to do but accept that's the way she is. Thank you. I manage to say after I clear my throat, but I don't offer to extend the conversation. I sure as hell don't want to talk about it further. Eden watches me carefully, and when I don't engage her, she sighs and turns from the kitchen. I hear her walk down the hall and start to climb the staircase. I brace for her reaction and figure it's coming in 3, 2, 1.
Cooper Dean Mayfield, you piece of shit!
She shrieks as she hits the top landing and sees her clothing spread out over the floor. I actually snicker to myself as I push up out of my chair. I can't help it, but it's funny to me that we're behaving like petulant children, and for some weird reason, I'm kind of relishing it. Maybe it's the catharsis I needed that I never got once Eden left. She's utterly quiet as I trudge up the stairs, and I'm surprised she's not still cursing me. I step over the piles of her clothing, bend over to pick up a lacy blue thong lying all by its lonesome, and rub it between my fingers as I walk into my bedroom. Figured that will really piss her off, me fondling her underwear. Instead, when I walk in, the smug smile slides right off my face and I drop her panties to the floor, completely erasing them from my mind. Anger washes through me as I watch her grab an armload of my clothes from the closet, walk over to the window she must have immediately opened as soon as she cursed at me, and dump my clothes right out the window. This, unfortunately, is the window of our circular room that faces the front of the house, and I imagine my clothes are scattered all over the holly bushes that border the front porch. What the fuck? I yell at her, but she turns and runs back to the closet. Grabs another armload and runs them to the window. I'm so stunned into inaction I can only watch with my mouth open. My clothes go flying out the window. Finally, I jolt and stomp over to her. Taking her by the arm, I stop her progress as she runs back to my closet. Are you goddamned crazy? She answers by elbowing me in the stomach, hard enough that I let her go as I double over. By the time I catch my breath and straighten back up, she's tossed another pile of clothes out the window. Son of a bitch! I yell, then look around helplessly. I should just push her ass into the closet and lock the damn door, but she's a hellion with that elbow and I'm not about to get physical with her. My eyes catch her blue thong on the floor, and an idea strikes. Two can play at this game. I run out into the hall just as Eden enters my closet. I skid to a halt by the pile of her clothes and scoop up the biggest armload I can muster, which is probably 3 times as much as Eden's thrown out the window so far. I run back into the room just as she's backing out of the closet with 3 pairs of my shoes in her hands. She stops dead in her tracks, eyes the clothes in my arms, and her mouth flattens. Don't you even dare. I bolt for the window. She drops the shoes and races me there, attempting to stop me. Too fucking bad.
I beat her by 3 seconds and toss her clothes right out.
You asshole!
She shrieks, and without a second thought, she bolts back to my closet. I jet to the hallway, intent on grabbing more of her clothes. My legs are longer, my intent is more driven, and I beat her back to the window easily. I chuck the pile and stick my head out so I can watch her lingerie flutter to the ground. Then my gaze goes to Clay, standing there, leaning up against the passenger door of his truck, watching us. He's got one leg crossed over the other at the ankles, arms folded on his chest, and a shit-eating grin on his face.
"Don't stop on my account,"
he hollers up at me. Eden pushes past me to stick her head out the window. She spots Clay standing there, and I turn my head to see her jaw clenched.
"Howdy, Eden,"
Clay says cheerfully.
"Welcome back home."
She doesn't respond to him, but takes in the articles of men's and women's clothing strewn all about the bushes and driveway. With a sigh, she pulls her head in through the window, and without even looking at me, walks out of the room. I note her head is high, her shoulders stiffly held back, and her hips naturally swaying, which I'm betting is from years on the catwalk. I watch her leave the room, and with a sigh of my own, I start walking after her. Just as I get partway down the staircase, Eden grabs her purse from the foyer table and regally walks out the door. I hear her car start up by the time I get to the door, and when I reach the porch, where Clay is waiting for me, she's halfway down the driveway.
"I take it things aren't going that great living together," Clay says.
I face him and have to restrain myself from punching that grin off his face. Instead, I tell him, "We're getting drunk tonight."
"We just went out last night,"
he practically whines. "For an hour," I remind him as I turn to head back into the house. "I've got some work to do. Meet you at Tilly's about 6.
"Fine," Clay snaps at me, then calls out, "But don't you want to know why I came by?"
"You came by to see how Eden and I were doing living in the same space," I call back over my shoulder. His answering laugh tells me I'm right.
Chapter 7. "What the fuck is wrong with you people?" Eden. "I don't know about this," I mutter to Missy as I walk into Tilly's. I'm not feeling sociable, and I'm slightly sick to my stomach because I've been eating cupcakes all afternoon at her shop. There's nothing to reason out why I went to Missy's Cupcake Gallery after I walked out of Goodnight House. I went there because I had nowhere else to go. I don't have any family here or friends here. Staying in that house with Coop was absolutely impossible, and there's no hotel in Newbury. And, well, cupcakes. I stayed there all afternoon and hung out watching Missy bake and frost. For each batch she did, I got to taste test. She chattered the entire time, keeping my mind occupied while jacking me up on sugar. I learned so much more about her, including the completely sad realization that I wish I'd taken the time to know her in high school. If she was feeling any awkwardness with me, because I probably wasn't all that nice to her, or was a famous award-winning actress who'd recently been publicly humiliated, she never showed it at all. She acted like I was just a normal person. She's wonderful, and I know I've latched onto her kindness because I'm feeling low myself. Throughout the afternoon, our conversation blessedly stayed away from the topic of Coop. I think that's because when I walked into her cupcake shop a little more than 6 hours ago, I snarled, "Cooper Mayfield is the biggest asshole on the face of the earth, and I need a cupcake like right now." She handed me a red velvet cupcake with cream cheese icing before the door even closed behind me. While we didn't talk about Coop, I was fascinated to hear about her love life. She married a guy she met in college who was a douchebag from the sound of it. When I'd asked Missy the details of why they divorced, she'd said, "After college, I quickly popped out 2 kids, which, according to my ex-husband, made me fatter than he'd ever hoped to have to deal with. So I left his judgmental ass and took my kids back home to Newbury, where I proceeded to lose weight and regain my self-worth. He came by, sniffing around after that, but I was banging a hot-as-hell fireman by that time and wasn't interested in what he had to offer anymore. Missy is utterly fascinating. Proud, stubborn, confident, and determined. More than anything, though, is her que-sera-sera attitude that she developed thanks to a lot of tribulations she overcame. She made me wish to be like that, because if I were, I could handle things better. Brad cheating on me, the paparazzi stalking me, Coop irritating the living hell out of me. Because she saved my sanity this afternoon, I didn't hesitate to accept her offer to have dinner and drinks tonight at Tilly's. It would delay me from heading home and dealing with Coop and my panties on the front lawn. But as soon as we walk inside the bar and I recognize several people looking at me standoffishly, I have regrets and second thoughts. "Fine," Missy says. "Turn around, run home, and deal with Coop then." "That booth over there looks nice," I say, pointing, as I realize this is the lesser of two evils. Missy snickers, and I follow her to the booth that sits in the corner near the alcove that leads to the restrooms. I'm self-conscious, not having had a chance to freshen up since the rampage in the master suite. I'm wearing a faded Atlanta Falcons t-shirt, a pair of white denim shorts, and ratty Chucks without laces that are the most comfortable shoes I own. I changed into these clothes before I left the house for lunch at the diner, feeling completely comfortable. But for dinner out tonight at Tilly's, where everyone shows up looking their best because it's the best place to hang out, party, and mingle, I look like a bum. So my goal is to eat and get out, although frankly, I'm not hungry. Too many cupcakes. I slide into the booth seat that faces the bathroom, putting my back to the main crowd. Tilly's has a large U-shaped bar at the back of the building, with a wooden dance floor in front of it. The perimeter houses booths, and the remaining space holds tables and chairs. The food is simple, but good, at least from what I can remember. There's usually live music on the weekends, too, but it's still early yet. So there's only the sound of people talking and flatware clanging against plates as diners eat. I give my back to the crowd because I've been uneasy with the interactions I've had so far. People look at me strange, almost as if they hate me. I can't figure out why. I'm a nice person, was well-liked when I lived here, because even though we were wealthy, I went to the same public high school as everyone else and acted like a regular person. I have to guess that perhaps people might be jealous of my success, but again, that doesn't make sense either. One or two people, sure, but everyone who looks at me? It just doesn't make sense. Unless it's all in my head. Maybe I'm still feeling so beat down by what Brad did to me, I feel like everyone's against me. I've never felt like this before, but I've never felt betrayed either. I suppose most people would turn to family and friends for support, but I don't have that. The most I have is a house that I have to share with my first love who can't stand me, and a former classmate I didn't even recognize who probably pity-fed me cupcakes today. "What are you going to have?" Missy asks as she grabs one of the trifold menus from the holder near the wall. "They've got a great ribeye steak here if you eat meat." "Totally eat meat," I say as I grab a menu too, but honest to God, I don't think I can fit anything else in my stomach. "But I think I might just go with a salad." "Too many cupcakes?" Missy guesses as she smirks at me over her menu. "Yep," I agree with a chuckle. "Please don't let me eat like that again when I'm in your shop." "I think it was warranted today," she tells me sympathetically. "So you've got your belly full. You can have a glass of wine or two to relax you, then go home and get a good night's sleep. Things will look better in the morning." With a sigh and a brave smile, I put down the menu and cross my forearms on the table. "Easy for you to say. You don't know the half of what happened." Missy tosses her menu on the table and also crosses her forearms on the table, then leans toward me with interest. Well, I didn't want to pry today. Figured you'd tell me details when you felt ready to. I'm drunk on sugar, I say. I'm ready. Hey, Missy, I hear from my left and turn to see a waitress. She's looking straight at